are listening to the Photobomb podcast with the world's greatest photographers, Boo Ray and Gary.
Hi, and welcome to the Photobomb podcast. My name is Boo Ray Perry, and joining me as always is Gary Hughes.
I had a dream about you.
And if we...
I did.
Wait, okay, are we going to introduce the third member of the team today?
Okay, but don't forget. Don't forget.
Don't forget. You had a dream about me?
Okay, introduce our guest.
And we have a guest today as well. And what a lovely way to bring you into the show. Mr. Kevin Newsom is with us today. Say hello, Kevin.
Hello, but nobody dreamed about me.
No one dreams about Kevin. We should take just a quick second to say Kevin is a photographer extraordinary. With a long history and there's much to learn from Kevin. Anytime I have a question about anything, I always call Kevin and Kevin's got an answer.
I've called Kevin several times for questions. Yeah, he's the Yoda of the photography world here in Florida.
So we thought what we would do is since we were going to be answering a lot of questions today, we would bring someone in with actual knowledge.
Oh, that's a good idea. Exactly.
Kevin's the ringer.
Why didn't we think of that sooner?
Yes, we should have thought about having someone on the show who actually knows what they're talking about.
That's a great idea.
Okay. As long as you confine it to subjects I know what I'm talking about.
That's right. Well, there's nothing you don't know about. I've never heard you say, I don't know. Anything I say to you, you've always got something.
Yeah, stick around. You'll hear it today.
We'll get Kay on the show next time.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so I heard that Gary had a dream about
it. I had a dream about you. Right, would you like to hear it?
Yes, I would like to hear it.
Okay. So we're at some kind of a party or something, and there are some photographers there, not photographers. Just those one of those weird intersection dreams with people from your life who don't know each other.
Okay.
And so we're in the second floor of this opulent house, probably like your house. And I step out onto the balcony, and it turns out it's just like a little false balcony right over the stoop. And so I get out there, and it's a very sheer drop. And I just stepped out to
I don't understand a false balcony.
Well, you know how like you go to a house and there's like it's got a elevated front, but it's not a real like it's not an actual weight bearing like you want to be hanging out on it balcony. It's a beautiful sunset. I walk out on it. I realize that it's not, and I step back. You know, and I go, whoa. And then you come right out behind me to talk to me, and you go over the edge. And then you and I are in like a Stallone cliffhanger thing. I reach down and grab you with one hand, and I'm hanging onto the balcony.
All right.
And then
let go of me, man. Don't you let me go.
And so I pull you up like in an amazing feat of strength.
Oh, like the one arm.
And I get you all the way back up to your hands, and you're holding on the balcony like just at chest level with both hands. And then you said, "I'm not strong enough to pull myself up."
True story.
So I go,
"True story, true story." I can't get back in the boat. Once I'm in the water, there's no getting back in the boat.
And so I had to get you back on one hand, and then with another amazing feat of strength, lower you down to the ground.
All one-handed the whole time.
And then drop you when you're like 2 feet from the ground.
All right.
And that was the whole dream.
So
what does it mean?
We're going to go to Kevin. And Kevin, I think that there's definitely some overtones of Gary's feeling that he's in some way carrying me through this entire episode.
I think he's saying he can save you in just about any situation.
I'm just saying
he is Stretch Armstrong.
He seems to feel that in our relationship, I am the weak person who basically is pulling down the entire team. Gary is the Superman. If we're the Super Friends, he's Superman and I'm Aquaman.
No, you're not even Aquaman. You're Robin.
Robin. Yeah, you're worse than Aquaman. Robin can't even talk to fish.
Robin without the Batman.
Yes, Robin the boy hostage.
Oh my goodness, that sounds.
That's an awful dream. That's an awful, awful dream.
I'm just telling you, I've been holding on to that one for a while, wanting to tell you about it.
I know you told Julie. Did she?
Of course, I told Julie.
What did Julie say?
She said, she asked me if I was having an affair with you. I said, I am. I'm having a podcast affair with Boo Ray Perry.
All right. Well, that's interesting. Oh, wait. You know what I'm going to do now? I'm going to set the timer on our podcast. We were just joking earlier today that I always, we're 15 minutes into the podcast before I set the timer, and then we wonder why the podcast run long. I might have something to do. Okay, so we're this timer plus like 5 or 10 minutes will be where we are on the podcast. So our topic today, we want to do a questions episode.
Yes, questions.
And we had a lot of people write in with different questions to ask on the show. And one of the reasons we wanted to bring Kevin on is because Kevin's got a great perspective on in areas that we don't. Kevin, and we have to say this about Kevin, this is what I love about Kevin. Kevin, would you tell us, please, where you started in photography? Because you know I love this. Yeah. What was your first photography job?
My first photography job was shooting baby pictures in a Kmart.
That's right, baby. That's
right. You don't get any more in the trenches of children's portraiture than that.
You
right
know,
there.
Some people have to put in their whole lives for that dream gig. And Kevin just got it right
That's
off the
right.
bat.
Right.
I answered an ad in the newspaper. That was my first foray into photography. I saw an ad that said, photographer, no experience necessary. I said, well, it sounds like me.
There you go. Photographer, no experience necessary.
And people say the photography industry now is different.
Yes.
It's exactly the same.
It was really funny because at the time, you know, that you were not, you know, you were a button pusher. And it was largely a volume thing. Everything was fixed focus, fixed f-stop at 16 so that you were never going to be out of focus.
There's no way you could mess that up.
And, you know, it was a dog and pony show. I learned more about children's psychology than I did photography.
Working with kids, talking to
working
them,
and
getting
dealing
good expression.
I could elicit three smiles in the kid in less than a minute and get the three shots I needed. It was a three-shot job. Headshot, three-quarter, full-length, two backgrounds, boom, give me your 99 cents and get out of here. And I would shoot anywhere from 100 to 200 kids in a day.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And what was the charge?
What was the charge?
What did they charge? What did you charge them? What did it cost?
It was a $12.95
package. $12.95
package. 57 portraits for $12.95.
Holy crap.
And that included four charms, you know, two 8x10s, three 5x7s, 15 wallets.
And you carry on that tradition. That's what you charge in your studio now.
Yeah. Barely $12.95. It was really funny because at the time, we all knew we weren't photographers, but that's what you were called. I mean, you pushed a button, but we didn't really know anything about photography. But we did learn an awful lot about child psychology and how to elicit expressions. And I carried that into my world as a photographer when I finally became a photographer.
You know what's amazing to me is that after doing that job that you would still want to be a photographer.
Well, there's a company that still does that today, and I'm not going to mention them by name, people, places. But find a picture. Yeah, I'm not going to mention them by name, picture people. But in the mall, and I had an actual client who I did her wedding, and she said she worked there. And I said, oh, well, then you're a photographer. And she said, no. She said the only instruction they gave us is try to get them to smile.
Yeah,
that's really all. That's all they're really told.
Yeah,
but the fact that you started Kmart, you said working in the trenches, and I'm a big fan of a podcast called "Here's the Thing" with Alec Baldwin.
Love "Here's the Thing,"
and if you listen to his podcast, whenever he has an actor on, he started in soap operas, and whenever he has an actor on who started in soap operas, there's a kinship that he has for them because you know that he has this feeling that you know if you started in soap operas, that's like the trenches of acting. It was every single day, 20 pages of dialogue, and it was really had to work hard in soap operas, even though they were terrible. It was hard, hard work, and that's what it must have been like to start in Kmart.
That's exactly what it was like.
Because Kevin has that to compare to his soap opera acting experience.
My soap opera acting experience happened at ages 10, 11, and 12. I was a stage theater child actor.
Is that right?
Whoa, how did I not know this?
Because I never told you that. But that's, in fact, you know, that was one of my extracurricular activities at that age. My mother was involved in theater, and she got me involved, and I acted on stage.
What was your most dynamic role?
Rufus Follett in All the Way Home.
Okay.
I have no idea what that is.
Well, in the movie version, Burt Lancaster played my father.
Oh, and well, so you and Burt Lancaster, like...
We were like buddies.
Well, I'm excited about the questions episode today because I've been wanting to do this for a while, and so we've got... a bunch, actually. You know what's shocking?
What is shocking?
People listen to this podcast.
Other than the fact that you have dreams where I am the weak member of the team that must be saved. Other than that,
I didn't say
shocking?
That. You just don't have good upper body strength.
True. That's all true.
The exciting thing about it is when we asked for questions for an episode, we actually had a bunch of people writing questions, which means that people are actually listening to this podcast. It's not just something that you and I get together and do. Is it people that listen? And so, actually, here, Kevin, you just started listening.
Yes.
When we asked you to come and do this with us.
Right.
So, someone who just started listening, what's your first impression on hearing it?
Well, I enjoyed it. I really did. And the fact that you two do sound like you know what you're talking about. You work very well as a team. And that makes a big difference. I mean,
you feel like...
You're like Felix and...
Yeah. Oscar.
Oscar.
But Felix and Felix. But you feel like, for the most part, I carry the show.
Yeah, until you fall off the balcony, then he carries you, right.
But, for some reason, my mom was there, too. I don't know why that...
Your mother was there.
Yeah, is that weird?
That's very weird.
Paging Dr. Freud.
I've never met your mother. Your mother was there, and I was there, and you were saving me.
Yes.
There's a whole therapy session. There's a good $500-$600 worth of therapy.
If you're one of our listeners and you happen to be a psychiatrist or psychologist who interprets dreams, feel free to email questions at photobombpodcast.com with your interpretation of my saving Bure's life dream. Okay, so Bure, we got questions.
Okay, so first question today from a Mr. Richard Fader of Fort Lee, New Jersey. The question is from Mandy Thompson, and she says, studio or no studio? I've been working from my home for the past few years, but have the opportunity to move into the upstairs of a friend's building for a studio. I feel like I need separation, but don't want the added expense. My clients already buck at how much I charge per hour, and that's her question. Studio or no studio? And it's a good question because I don't have a studio. You do have a studio. And
right.
Kevin, of course, a long-standing studio, has been a studio photographer for years. So let's go with Kevin first.
Well, I've always had a studio. I started with a studio because after I left my job with the dog and pony show at the discount stores, I did go to the Art Institute of Atlanta, and I took photography there. I did not finish. I ran out of money and left and came back, went back to work for the same company, married my wife who has a degree in photography from the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale, and then we bought the studio from the guy who shot our wedding. So our first full-time studio was in business for 50 years when we bought it. It was founded in 1936. So we took over an existing studio that was shooting about 40 weddings a year. We kept that. We built on that. I've never worked out of my home as a photographer professionally. It's, to me, I love the separation, and I'm willing to pay for that separation. When I go home at 5, 6, 7 o'clock at night, whatever it is, I can walk away from the post-production, and I can feel, I can sit down and I can have a beer and not worry about, I really need to go in the other room and edit, because I know that's what people do now.
It's huge. I don't think you can overstate how huge that point is, because a guy like me, I'm never really away from work. Ever.
It gives me my sanity back. I mean, I can maintain a stable mentality about the whole industry if I can walk away from it for blocks of time, and my evenings are my own.
I got to agree. I worked out of, Julie and I had our business in our home for the first 6 years, and although it is really, really cool and convenient in a lot of ways, because there's no getting ready, driving to work time. But then also, you have to build your business around location photography. And that business model can be a really good one, but it's a little more difficult in the way that if you've got a shoot that takes an hour, you start getting ready to leave an hour before that, depending on how far away it is. And then it's an hour after that before you get back, unload your equipment. So you're talking in the space of 3 hours, you can do one shoot. Whereas in my studio now, in the space of 3 hours, I can do three or four different shoots in the studio. And so having it, yes, it costs more money, but it also enables you to make more money.
Right.
Also, you have a little more legitimacy. You have a actual physical space where you can do events, be involved with networking groups, chamber of commerce, BNIs, and you can host groups. And as a photographer right now, photography is something everybody needs. And so if you're in one of those networking groups, you'd be like, having a party at my studio just for the networking group. We're going to give everybody a social media headshot. I mean, anything you can think of, and you've got a place to do it. Not to mention that when your studio is not in your house, you don't have to keep your house immaculately clean all the time.
Yeah,
it's funny. The cleanest my studio is when I know another photographer's coming over. I
Absolutely.
Spend more time cleaning for other photographers than I do for my own clients. And that's a terrible thing to say, but the reality is a photographer is going to critique you much deeper than a client will. A client, you definitely need to keep a clean environment for your clients to spend their money. But when I know a photographer's coming, or if I'm having a meeting and there's a tapa board meeting or something like that at my studio, that place is spotless.
So here's my question. You have a studio, and you say that this gives you opportunities to make more money. Mm-hmm. So my question is, do you feel that the opportunities to make more money because you have a studio are enough to pay for the cost of the studio? Because my biggest fear, and I think a lot of people, is they say, if I get a studio, now that's overhead has come in. So now I immediately have to increase my bottom line by X amount of dollars just to cover the studio. So now that may mean 20% more work or whatever, just to get to where I am now without the studio. And my question is, how much of that extra work you have to do you feel comes easily simply because you have a studio?
I think it depends on what type of work you do. Your business model has a lot to do with it. So, for example, you're a wedding photographer who shoots primarily beach weddings. And the only time you really need to see your client, you probably a lot of your clients you don't even meet in person before you photograph
them. Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And also, but the ones that you do, you just need a place to meet your clients. So I know a lot of photographers are doing that at like a Starbucks or somewhere like that, which is fine. But you don't have to get a whole studio with a camera room, and you don't have to have an office where you work there. If you can get together with a wedding planner
right.
or a DJ and rent a small little office space and decorate it real nice, just a place to meet with clients, that brings you that legitimacy without actually having to have the overhead yeah. of a full space.
Oh, I'm huge on that. I tell people all the time who want to do weddings, I'm like, you've got to find some place to meet people other than a Starbucks or a Panera Bread.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. But in this particular instance, we're talking about having a full studio. Let's say you're a person who shoots, you know, we shoot kids and we shoot families and we do all that stuff, and I'm thinking about getting a studio space, and now I'm adding, you know, I don't know, what, $3,000 a month or so to my bottom line, or it could be, you know, in cost of a studio.
Depends on where you live in the country.
Yeah, depends on what you do.
What part of town?
So right away, now I've got to get that extra money every single month just to be where I am now working out of my home. How much of that, how hard is that going to be? That's my question. How hard do you think it is to increase your business because you have a studio? How much does the studio help you increase your business?
It just happens, doesn't it? It
sort of does, but I look at it in reverse. Because I've always had a studio, what would I lose if I no longer had a studio? If
right.
I worked out of my home, what market can I no longer service? What will I lose? There are plenty of executives that I do headshots for that don't have a place to go to get a headshot. They're going to come to me. Okay, they don't have an office. They work out of their home,
like independent real estate agent.
Absolutely.
And stuff like that.
And they don't have a place for me to go set up, and don't necessarily want to do it outdoors in the environment. They want a studio look. Okay, no problem. They can come to me. That I'm going to lose that business. I'm going to lose people who come to me for the simple old traditional stuff, passports, copy and restoration, just little things like that. That I get more old ladies who call me that are booking a family portrait for their grandkids or something like that because their kids are coming into town. They only call studios.
Right.
They don't
They're
call
old school.
Addresses. They look to the Yellow Pages, believe it or not. And it was a time when that was the only advertising you had that was
yeah.
it was accessible to everybody was the Yellow Pages. And now it's the internet. Well, some of these older folks, that generation doesn't necessarily Google. So they will go to the Yellow Pages. Now, I still have a commercial phone line, so I'm listed. I'll just have a listing. I don't have an ad. I've just got a listing. But I get people who call me. How did you find me? Yellow Pages. And I'm cracking up thinking, seriously?
Yeah, who's using the Yellow Pages?
Yeah, who uses that?
Wait, what's the Yellow Pages?
Yes, it's this book, Gary. It's this big book that used to be delivered to your house.
And like an encyclopedia?
Yeah, and it mostly used it for killing bugs and sitting on.
Well, you know what? I think to summarize the answer to this question is there are huge advantages to having a studio. The biggest advantage of not having a studio is obviously it costs a lot less money.
Yeah.
And I think that any photographer who's really serious about having their business should be looking forward to transitioning into some sort of a professional space, whether it be just to meet clients or to work out of. And I got to say, after doing it for the last, you know, the first 6 years of our business and then the last couple of years in studio, it is far, far superior. The advantages of what you're able to do with your business are far outweigh the cost that you save. And we don't have an expensive retail storefront in a fancy part of town. I'm in an industrial part of town. My next door neighbor is a cabinet place. My other next door neighbor is a Baptist church, you know, and we're in this, you know, and it's not a bad part of town. It's just industrial. And my rent, you know, and it keeps the rents low. You get a lot of space for not a lot of money, but still that legitimacy you get from your clients, the ability to be working on other stuff right up until my client walks in the door. I'm not packing stuff up and loading everything I own right. into my car and driving out. And the other thing is I still do a lot of location work, but now I charge extra. So if I've got an office full of attorneys or financial advisors or whoever, they want all headshots done for their office. I said, well, here's our studio, and here's what we charge for a location fee. So now, schlepping and taking all my crap in the car and driving over there, I actually get paid extra to do that.
Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, though, to take the opposite side of that just a little bit. For me personally, one of the big drawbacks to me to having a studio is I don't want to have to get up and get dressed and drive to work.
That's because you're a bum.
I am. I don't set my alarm. I get up when I get up, and I wander into my office, and I start working in my pajamas or whatever.
Blu-ray does not wear pants.
I really don't.
He's not wearing
pants
right now.
Not wearing pants now. And so, to me personally, that's, to me, is one of the good things about being, you know, owning your own business and being able to work from home, is that I have that. I love the fact that I don't, you know, I think about you, you gotta get up, gotta go down, unlock the door, go into the studio. Now I'm at the studio and I'm working all day in the studio. Whereas me, if I'm working, I can be working for an hour and be like, I'm gonna take a break and go watch TV, or I'm gonna go whatever I want and then come back to it. And I like that, but it also results in, you know, working until 8 o'clock every night. So, I mean, I guess it's a double-sided coin.
Isn't it a personality thing, though, for someone? I'm not the type of person who does well working at home. Neither is Julie. We get distracted. It's like, oh, I'll just throw on a load of laundry. And when it's lunchtime, you go into the kitchen and you have an extra long lunch. And the cool thing is that when you're at the studio, all there is to do at the studio
is studio stuff.
It's work.
Yeah. Right.
And then, and I find that we're getting out of the studio at 5, 6 o'clock latest most days, and we're home, where home time becomes...
Home time.
And that's actually really cool. We're at home, and if you're binge-watching House of Cards or whatever on Netflix, and it's 9 o'clock at night, and you know you've still got a wedding to process, and it's just, or whatever, and it's just throbbing, that room that you use as your office, it's just kind of like one of those...
It's calling you. It's always calling you. Yeah. So this morning, I got up. I'm at home. This morning, I got up. I look at the clock. It's an hour until you guys get here. Well, I can just start. I can... And I'm in there working.
Right.
Sunday morning.
Right.
Right.
Why? See, that's... Again, it's personality. It's your business model. But take from that what you will, and hopefully some of that helps you. But the bottom line is that it's going to depend a lot on what type of business that you have.
One more question on this topic. You've got a studio now. What would you say is the easiest, most effective, most common, whatever, the easiest way to utilize that studio right out of the bat to increase your bottom line? What form of photography, what form of client do you find is easiest to use that studio to make money on?
Well, that's going to boil down to exactly what your market is to begin with. I mean, if you're into newborns, then you've got a studio for newborns.
Right.
I'm into headshots for executives, so that's what I would be drawing. That's the market I would aim at.
Me too.
You know, so it's amazing. But you, if you're whatever your specialty is, focus on that. And if a studio business works for, as a business model for you, then make it work.
We've had a lot of success with events at the studio, having, you know, and I got a friend of mine in Orlando, too, who does it a lot the first Friday of every month. He has, like, a headshot kind of party.
I'm very envious of that.
And he does.
People I know who have studios, and again, because we travel and we speak and stuff like that, or I'm putting together a class for momtography or whatever, and I'm so envious of the people who have a studio, and they always have this place where they can host an event, they can teach a class, they can have a PPA event. They always have a place where
it's
they
the
can
biggest
have,
leverage. You
I
have.
Love it. Yeah, I think in many ways that may be the space is the value even more than the shooting space.
And you know what? If saving cost, another word on saving cost is, if you're a baby photographer and you got a friend who's a wedding photographer, you can split a space without conflicting with each other's business. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's complimentary.
Right.
And I know plenty of photographers that have done that over the years. So look for somebody who is specialized in a different area and share a space with
just
them.
Just co-op, yeah.
So what's the next question?
That's a good question. What is the next question? Our next question is, what is the next question? The next question has to do with white balance. And this is directed to you, Gary, specifically, and it's from Michael Zervitz. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing your
Zervitz.
Name wrong.
Zervitz.
Thank you. And Gary said, tell me about color balance. He said, Gary, tell me about color balance and white balance. I want perfect color regardless of changing light conditions. Can I just set a custom white balance in my camera using a gray card or an Expo disc or a Gary Fong gray disc? Or do I need a system like Passport Color Checker? Or do I do it in RAW, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So let's talk about color balance and how each person handles color balance. We'll start with Gary.
Sure. Michael is actually a friend of mine, and so thank you for writing in, Michael. I appreciate that. What do we do? I have actually, you mentioned the Color Checker Passport from X-Rite. I do have that, and I like that, especially for those of you photographers who are working on location a lot. It's absolutely awesome. It fits in your back pocket. But basically, I think that getting a good white balance starts with understanding how your camera works and how metering works, and then also being able to see changing light conditions. Because although the auto white balance on a camera a lot of time does a pretty darn good job, if for some reason, let's say you're in the studio and you're shooting with Pocket Wizards, your camera isn't going to know that you're hooked up to a bunch of studio lights necessarily. So it could give you the ambient room's white balance, and when that light hits from the strobes, it's going to look totally wrong. So just a carry around gray card is the way to go. And the other thing you can do is in Lightroom and in Adobe Camera Raw, you can create a color profile for your specific camera, because every camera, even the cameras that came off the line on the same day, can have a slightly different color profile. My camera is the 5D Mark III I use. really kind of leans a few points red, like 6 or 7 points red, even when I do a perfect wipeout. And I know that. And one of the best ways to do that is I have a preset in Camera Raw and in Lightroom just for my camera that will reduce some of the red out of the image right off the bat. And also making sure that you're using a monitor to edit on is color calibrated is huge, because I actually have two monitors side by side. One is calibrated for print, and the other one's just a monitor straight out of the box. So what my client would be viewing the image on if it gets put online, kind of a thing. And I look at it on that before I post it online, and before I send it on print, I edit it on the other one. So I'm obsessive about color.
Yeah, I was just about to say, you're really, really, you know, because that's about, you know, there's 10 things you mentioned there, and there's about 9.5 that I don't do.
I would recommend also, first of all, you got to find out what your eye is like, I think, to really rewind it. You can do an online color acuity test. And I know that plenty of places have them, including Pantone's website, and there are a few others where they give you like a maroon tile and a red tile, and there are 30 tiles in between each one shade different, and they get mixed up, and you have to put them in order, and you do that in several different shades, and then it tells you basically if you're colorblind or not.
Oh, wow. It's the dress blue or is the dress gold?
Yeah, and so you know what your eye is doing, because everybody sees a little bit differently, especially if you're male. I know males have a higher rate of color deficiency than females. And so make sure that you know if you actually can see color or not is kind of important too. But Kevin, you must have some thoughts on white balance.
Yeah, I use the dropper in Lightroom, and I hit that tablecloth, and the entire room gets perfectly white balanced every single time. So the tablecloth,
got to be something white in that room that I can click
somebody's
on.
Somebody's got on a white shirt, a white stripe in their tie. Right. They've got a tablecloth. There's a curtain. There's something that's going to be white. And I drop it, and it boom.
But you're talking about events.
Yes.
In studio, I'm guessing studio, you set your camera to 5200K because you're using studio lights.
No. I do a custom white balance on my camera, shooting a white balance card.
Okay.
And so that just follow the instructions in the manual. I couldn't tell you how to do it now. It's been a while since I've done it. I do it about every 8 or 10 months.
Now, wait a minute. When you say do a custom balance using a white balance card, you want to set perfect color in the camera as
yes.
opposed to just shooting a card
yes.
and then adjusting it in Lightroom.
Right. Yeah, my camera can set basically a white balance based on the lighting system.
Every DSLR
camera.
In
right.
the world right now can do that.
Right.
I
yeah.
just wanted to point that out.
You
in
shoot
case
a gray, you shoot a gray card and you say this is gray and the camera then adjusts.
Well, okay, so understanding why is because cameras' meters are meant, they basically, if you were to look at the world, anything you're viewing through your eyes, let's say you were able to stick a paint stir right into the scene in front of you and mix it up, chances are all those colors blended together would turn out pretty darn close to that medium gray that's the color of a white balance card in most cases. So cameras are designed to take a scene, evaluate it, and then put the color balance as if it's trying to balance with that color gray, which is
right.
why you shoot a gray card to get that color balance. So you're telling the camera, under this lighting conditions, this is what that color
right.
gray,
this should be gray
is supposed to be. And that's how that works.
But you set your custom balance with a gray card.
No, it's got a white stripe, a gray stripe, and a black stripe.
Mm-hmm.
And so you shoot you that with your camera, and you say, this is my custom. Because I always thought you just shot gray.
No, there's white, too. The set that I bought has two cards, and one is pure white, so you fill the frame with that
right.
and shoot it. The white card is the one that was built for digital cameras versus film cameras. They see white a little bit differently. And so I bought that one. I think it was like $95 back when it first came out. I don't know, maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago. And I fill the frame with that. I shoot it. I tell the camera that's a white card. And it automatically, based on these lights, and as long as I have it set to custom white balance, as long as I'm in the studio or anytime I'm using those strobes, even if I take them on location, I set it to that custom white balance.
Okay, but here's what I don't understand about that, is that you can set that custom white balance with that white card, but you could also set a custom white balance with a gray card.
Yes. It's just
how does the camera know you've switched cards?
I don't know.
Yeah, you know, that's the other thing. I've never
See,
understood
that.
See, you
just heard that. Me say, I don't know. Yeah, never,
let's call Canon support right
I'm
now.
Just saying, you would think that it would always have to be a gray card or it would always have to be a white card, and the camera's
no.
like, that's supposed to be white.
Because,
how does it know?
Because it doesn't. I don't think it matters, because when you take the eyedropper in Lightroom, you can touch white, and you're going to get pretty much the same setup, same light. Same
magic.
White balance.
It's magic.
Yes.
I really don't know how it works.
And I also know photographers that shoot pretty much just auto white balance and fix it later. And one of the reasons I don't do that is because when we shoot a wedding, you know, and you've got, you could turn your head and the camera will give you a different white balance than it did just a second ago. Mm-hmm. And so you find yourself having to go to each individual image and correct. Here's one thing that I do when I shoot weddings. If I'm not sure about the white balance, I just set it to like cloudy or flash. And even if it's the completely wrong white balance, at least I only have to correct the one image and all the ones after it in that same scene. It's just one batch correction for all of them.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are ways. I know plenty of photographers that use their cameras and white balance in creative ways. You don't have to be that guy with a white card and a light meter if you don't want to be that guy. But just shoot intelligently and know that your camera is going to make mistakes. And if you anticipate that when your camera is going to make mistakes, you can actually counter that.
Okay, the way that you do it, where you set one solid thing, mm-hmm. I get that. And I don't. I shoot in auto all the time. But the reason is
a nightmare.
Well, the reason is because that doesn't work for me. And the reason is because I've got flash in the scene. And because I'm changing the settings on my camera, I am getting different amounts of ambient versus flash. So if I set everything to, say, cloudy, and this picture is at 2.8 with my flash pushing, 16th of a power, and the next one is at 5.6 and my flash is pushing, twice as much light into the scene now to overpower the ambient, the mix, the soup of light, tungsten versus flash, has now just drastically changed. So having them all set to cloudy, it's still they're going to look different. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I might as well just shoot them at auto white balance and fix them all with the damn eyedropper tool.
You got to do them individually.
But you'd have to do them individually anyway.
No, you don't.
Yes, you do, because if one is like...
If it's all from the same sequence, you just fix the first one and batch correct the
rest. Well, no, if they're all from the same sequence and you didn't change the settings in your camera, no, right. You don't have to. But I'm talking like at a reception where I'm constantly changing the settings. And that's probably my problem. I should try to stay more consistent with my settings.
Well, for me, in a reception setting, I light the room as much as I can, anytime I can. If you're on the beach or the wedding's outdoors, a lot of times you cannot.
Right.
But I do try to light the room. I'm using a lot of strobes and speed lights and stuff like that. And so I know, you can set it to, let's say, 1600 ISO at f4 at 80th of a second, and that's my wedding setting sometimes. And everything I shoot within the range of that dance floor and the foreseeable area around it is going to be the same mm-hmm. setup.
Right.
And so that's easier to correct. But I can't imagine micro correcting as you shoot a reception. Changing your settings while you're
while I'm shooting
the
reception?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Because my thing is, what I'll do is I like to play with really shallow depth of field, and I miss it, a lot. So if I've got somebody doing if I've got a first dance going on, I'm gonna shoot it at 5.6. I'm gonna shoot my close ups or something at 5.6. And as long as I know I've got them, then I'm gonna crank it to 2.8 and try and nail a couple that where I've got a good focus on her face and everything else is really really blurry. But I may not get it, and I may have to fall back to the 5.6 as being the main image that I use.
So are you saying that you spray and pray?
No, I don't spray and pray. No. There's a difference between spray and pray and what I do. What I do is I push to see how far I can push the limit of my camera, the shake, holding the camera steady with a long lens.
And a reception is a perfect place to do that.
Who cares? So you're going to, you can shoot them when they're doing the first dance. You can do 50 shots of that. So you get, 10 or 15 where you know exactly what you're doing. I got locked in. Or I do this at the ceremony a lot. If you're standing back with a long lens and you're zooming in on the bride's face, okay, it's 5.6, bang, 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 and then it's take it to 2.8 and see and shoot a couple more and see, and if I can really get a shallow depth of field on them. And if I don't, I still get the 5.6s.
So are we done with the white balance question?
No. There was one other point I wanted to make. We got to cover the whole thing. There was one other point I wanted to make, and that is I use Bridge, whereas almost everybody uses Lightroom.
I'm a Bridge camera raw guy myself. Yeah.
Okay. There is one thing that Lightroom can do. Well, there's two things that I know of that Lightroom can do that Bridge cannot do. And I wish Bridge could do this. Are you listening, Photoshop? And the Lightroom can do. And that is this. If you select a batch amount of images in Bridge, and then you want to go, say you've got them all corrected, the color's correct, and now you want to move them all just a little bit warmer, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you select them all in Bridge, and they're all correct, and they're not at the same white balance, say you've individually done them, but they're all correct now. Mm-hmm. If you select them all, and then you go and you move your slider just a little bit to the orange side, a little bit warmer, all of them are now going to move to that new setting.
Right.
So some of them, which were at different settings to begin with, are now no good. But if I'm correct, in Lightroom, you can select a bunch and have them all be at different color temperatures, and then just click a little bit warmer.
Kevin's looking at me like,
listen,
I have no
listen
idea
to what I'm saying. Then click a little bit warmer, and it will take each one a little bit warmer from where it currently is.
That's cool.
I don't know.
That's actually really cool.
You see what I'm saying? Yeah. Yeah. It keeps its original setting and then goes a little bit warmer, right. Whereas Bridge just resets them all to what the new temperature
That's
is.
It. I'm going to Lightroom.
Yeah, that right there. And, no, and when you're talking about a wedding and you get all the soup. And listen, I did a wedding the other day, and I took a picture of this room. I was going to do a post about it. I took a picture of a room. On the left, big white, big windows, bright beach day, big windows. In the middle, tungsten light ceiling fans, and directly to the right, dance floor with fluorescent lighting.
Mm-hmm.
It was and me with a flash.
That's
I mean, it was the perfect storm of yeah. every type of light source you could have in a room.
Right. In that case,
black and white.
Well, black and white, baby. Yeah. Black and white.
Exactly.
That's right.
Kevin, you beat me to it by like a second. Yes, yes, Michael, and if all else fails, make your image black
that's
and white.
That's it, man.
It's artistic. That's when you tell a client, you know, I took these black and white because I felt that the contrast and the contour was there. And you say that, and when you do it online, all the other photographers are like, yeah, that's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah,
you
couldn't handle it. We know better.
You couldn't. White balance.
If I see black and white reception images, I'm
yes,
like, yep.
Yeah, that's yep. what that is.
It had a DJ with laser lights.
Yes, you know? That's right.
It's you overexposed that one, didn't you?
Black and white. Artsy.
All right, we got time for a couple more, probably.
All right, one more question. I think we have time for one more question. And this question comes from Emily. And she says, I'm glad you are doing a question show. I'm in my early 20s, student loans out the wazoo, and trying to work towards a strong financial future. This leads to my first question. What is your advice for being able to afford adequate equipment for photographing weddings?
I got it. You can get a gun really cheap and then just rob a store.
Rob a store.
Yeah. Because
there is no cheap anymore.
I actually have a couple of points on this. And Bure, I know you'll definitely want to speak to this. Yeah. I remember when I wanted the Canon 70-200 2.8 IS-2 came out. And when it came out, it was like $2,000-something. It was like expensive.
Yeah.
It's a very expensive lens. And I remember that I actually thought about it, and Julie and I talked about it. It's like, let's put it on a credit card. Let's just get it. I'm like, no, we're going to be smart. We're not buying a bunch of stuff that we can't afford. And so I rented it. We do about 15 weddings a year or so. So I would rent it when I had a wedding. And it would cost me about $30-40 to rent it for a weekend.
That's not bad.
It isn't bad. But at the same time, I was also, you know, putting a little money aside until I could afford it. So, but one of the things I would recommend is the equipment that you can rent inexpensively, you can rent. The other thing you can do is for wedding photography, and I know that there's a whole bunch of photographers are going to roll their eyes and that are going to start writing angry tweets about this. But you can use pretty inexpensive glass and get a lot done on your average wedding.
You can.
There's a really inexpensive, relatively inexpensive lens. I know that Tamron makes a 28-300 and an 18-200, and they are image stabilized. They're macro capable. They're not super fast. They're f4, 5, 6, so it's right. Like... they're not. You're not going to be able to do those f/2.8 shallow depth of field. But
how often do you?
I
can't. I live at 5.6.
I mean,
I'm using a 2.8 lens. It costs $2,000, and I'm living at 5.6.
I rock f/4 a lot, but you know, it's very, very popular style to shoot at like f/1.2. That 85-1.2 and that 50-1.2 from
Canon.
Yeah,
you want a prime lens.
Massively popular. But I will tell you this: if you don't have a lot of money and you're looking to shoot some weddings, you can save a lot of money. I just saw the brand new one from Tamron, and it actually takes fantastic pictures.
Right,
28-300, f/4-5.6.
Yes, and you think a guy who works on the beach and has to carry all of his lenses with him? You think that I don't every 6 months think that?
Much it is though?
How much?
$800.
I could get every 6 months, I'm like, if I had that, I could just buy that lens and then I wouldn't have to swap lenses. That lens would shoot the whole wedding.
I saw one on eBay the other day for $450. Same lens.
See, I would buy that then just to,
you know,
just to find out.
And
I mean, the focus isn't quite as, it's not as fast, and I don't think the focus is as sharp, and I already own L-series glass. But if I didn't own L-series glass, it would be very hard for me to justify it sometimes when you can get a Tamron lens or a Sigma lens. Sigma especially, I think, has really been upping things with their glass.
Well, if you're really concerned about that shallow depth of field too, there are some great softwares out there that do a simulated like tilt shift, and Photoshop got a great tilt shift, and you can do how do you pronounce it? Bokeh. Whatever that is that makes the background blurry. There's a lot of ways to do that software-wise. It's fine, but if you're looking to save some money, that's a great way to do it, because the cameras nowadays, the ISOs are so good at high ISOs for weddings and stuff, that you can shoot at 3200 like 400 used to look on my old D10. You know what I mean? When you would, I remember you used to pull out that camera and you would go up to like ISO 400 and you're like, you know. Yeah. And now I was shooting a wedding the other day at 6400 ISO and the pictures are great.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? And it's no big deal. So that glass that can go really, if it's just the exposure you're looking for, that's where I would start, first of all, and also renting equipment. You have any tips on money saving, Blu-ray?
Well, I'm going to go against you on a couple little things there.
Shocking.
I do believe that if you I built my business on Sigma and Tamron lenses and Canon 40D cameras, and I've got great images from back then, and you can do great work. But I also am in that situation because I have other shooters who shoot for me. That I'm shooting with my 5D Mark III with L-series glass, and I have other shooters who are shooting with other cameras who are using Tamron and Sigma lenses. And yes, I do see a difference in the images. My wife sees a difference in the images between my stuff and their stuff, shot on the same day on the same beach. When you look at them, yes, there is a difference in quality glass. The question is it a $1,200, $1,300 difference when you've got student loans out the wazoo?
Yeah, you're 22. You're starting a wedding photography business.
Like, I think it's something that you might, you say, it's something I want to aim for down the road. But the idea that you can't be a good professional photographer shooting weddings without a $2,000 lens is just bull. You absolutely can.
Horse crap. Absolutely.
Kevin?
Wouldn't hurt to have an envelope that you mark it. 10% and 10% of every sale goes into that envelope.
Amen.
And eventually you can buy whatever you want. Just how long can you wait? So generate as much money as you can. It's the Dave Ramsey method as far as that goes.
Right.
And you just create an envelope for it and throw 10% of every sale into that envelope and just earmark it. That's equipment. You've got to recapitalize your business.
But let me also say this, and this because I see this all the time. I know somebody who had a 7D, Canon 7D, and she was like, yeah, I'm saving him because I want to get a Mark III. And I said, you don't have a backup camera. You do not need a Mark III. You need a backup camera before you get a Mark III. And I see this all the time. People are saving money because I want the L-series glass and I want the Mark III. And I'm like, no, you need a second flash. You need a backup camera. Yeah. You need – because you can shoot all the weddings you want with Sigma or Tamron glass or 7D, which is a fine camera. But you have one wedding that goes south because your camera broke and you didn't have a backup. And now you may have just hobbled your business for years to come.
Or ruined someone's wedding.
Well, you've ruined someone's wedding, but also you've hobbled your business.
I was shooting an event back in January where I set up put a camera on a tripod. It was going with such a slow shutter speed that I used a remote to trigger it. Okay, and you have to set a certain setting to use that remote. Well, when I finished doing that particular shot and I got to where I was, okay, I'm going to carry the camera around, take a few more handheld pictures, I forgot it was set on the remote setting. So all of a sudden, I'm pushing the button. Nothing's happening. It will not take a picture.
Right.
I'm starting to have a slight panic attack inside, realizing that all of a sudden my number one camera has just gone down. I changed the lens. I changed the remote. I changed the flash. I changed the battery. I changed the card. I changed everything, and it would not fire. And it was starting to really – it was very disconcerting.
The flop sweat.
I am in Miami, okay? It's not like I can just run some – call somebody real quick and say, quick, bring me a camera. But I had my spare camera on me. I pulled it out very calmly, put the flash on it, put the lens on it I wanted, took three or four more shots, then told the client, because this was one of those dinner situations, I told the client, I said, look, I've got all the shots I need from here. I'm going to get back to the hotel and download so that you'll have everything by the time you get back. And they said, okay, sure, no problem. As I'm sitting in the Uber car on the way back to my hotel, I looked down and I noticed it is set on remote. And I had all this time, I had a panic and left the job because my camera wouldn't fire. And it was just, I forgot to turn it back to single shot.
Should have had a V8.
Yeah, exactly. But I'll tell you, that was the best lesson and the best timing for that lesson. Had that happened early in the morning, I could have gone all day and not known what was wrong with it.
Yeah.
But on the way back, I looked down, and in the dark of the Uber car, I picked up the camera, I shot it out the window, took a perfect photograph, and I said, okay, well, I'm back in business.
I had it happen to me at a wedding, just about to start the ceremony, and I pull up my camera to take a quick test shot of the aisle, and nothing happens. And I look at the top, and it says 00. I'm like, zero, what the hell is 00?
No
lens.
It's
not working. It's not working. Hello. And it's not working. It's not working. And I had swapped the lens, and I hadn't locked it all the way down. I didn't know it at the time.
Right.
All I knew was I couldn't get it to work. And so and I didn't have time to figure it out. So I just ran to my case, grabbed my backup camera,
exactly,
and came back and shot the ceremony with the backup camera, and then later realized, I hadn't locked the lens down, and that's what had happened. But if I hadn't had that backup camera, So, I mean, you're much better off with Tamron Sigma lenses and a backup camera and a backup flash and plenty of batteries and stuff. That's where your money should go first.
Yeah, don't let anybody tell you you got to buy the most expensive stuff to be good. I remember my dad, who's a great photographer, always said, you know, the old adage, which the best camera is the one you got in your hand. But he also said a great photographer can come back, take a shoebox with a hole in it, and come back with the picture that's going to be good. So the art of photography is really going to be more in you than the tools that you're using, and that's the thing that has to come first.
All right, and I think that does it for today.
Kevin, thank you so much for being with us. Would you like to come back and do another episode?
I would love this.
Oh, good.
I think, you know, we need to get to more questions, so let's do another questions episode for the next one.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, so we'll be back. Bure, you want to lead us out, give us the email, the website, and all that stuff?
The website is photobombpodcast.com. The email address is questions@photobombpodcast.com. We are on Twitter. We are on Facebook. You can get a hold of us there. You can contact me and Gary directly on Facebook and friend us.
And we just started a YouPorn channel, which is great.
Fantastic YouPorn channel. There's look for the cliffhanger balcony episode.
Super erotic.
It's going to be coming out soon on the YouPorn channel. Until next time, take care.
See you later.